Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All those mean things everybody said about the Federal Reserve yesterday, that Bernanke's out of touch and behind the economy, never mind. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is the 12th of December today. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. The Fed cut short-term interest rates a quarter of a percentage point yesterday. We told you about that and about the attendant howls that the Fed blew it, that the credit squeeze is way worse than anybody thought. Today, Mr. Bernanke and company went a long way toward changing that impression. They have come up with a new way to get liquidity liquid again. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay is here to explain it all to us. Hiya, Jill.
Hi, Kai.
How is what the Fed announced today going to work? And more importantly, how is it different from what they're already doing?
The first thing it's important to understand is what the Federal Reserve is trying to solve. The problem is frozen credit markets. Banks, good solvent banks, don't want to lend to each other because they're afraid they won't get paid back. Now, the Fed has two levers to address banking crises like this. They have open market operations, like yesterday when they cut the federal funds rate by 25 basis points. And they have the discount window, where banks can go directly to the Fed to get money. But the problem with the discount window is that there's a big stigma attached to it. And other banks that have used it have found that they've had a run on the bank when it got out that they used it. So the Fed is creating this brand new third lever that supposedly combines the best features of its existing levers without the drawbacks. Any financial institution can go to it. You can pledge any kind of collateral, even like subprime mortgage bonds, to get your Fed money. And it's a big party where lots of people are there. So you have anonymity and there's no stigma if you go get the money from this new Fed auction.
Yeah, big party at the Fed. That's exactly what this sounds like. Listen, help me understand something, though. Why go through all of this instead of just yesterday cutting by half a percentage point instead of a quarter?
In a word, Kai, inflation. The Fed is very worried that any money it pumps into the system right now will spark an inflationary spiral. And so the idea here is that all the money that it puts up in auction, it'll take that money away elsewhere. It's going to keep its monetary targets the same so that it hopes not to spark inflation.
What about this other part of the announcement today, that the Fed's going to be working with foreign banks on the liquidity crunch?
Yeah, the Federal Reserve is coordinating with four foreign central banks who are going to be holding parallel auctions along with the Federal Reserve. And the reason why is that many of the banks that are embroiled in the credit crunch are foreign-owned, like UBS, Deutsche Bank, and they're part of the private bank lending market. They're having problems like the U.S. banks. But because they're foreign-owned, they can't go directly to the Fed all the time. And that's why foreign central banks are stepping in.
To get U.S. dollars into the system, right?
Exactly.
All right. Here's the big payoff pitch, though. Is this whole thing going to work?
Well, the people I talk to say we don't know yet. The biggest issue is that it may not get to the heart of the problem. The reason that banks are not lending to one another is that they don't trust one another. They're afraid that other banks are sitting on piles and piles more of mortgage bond losses. And until all these losses get disclosed and they know where are the safe places to lend and where are the risky places to lend, they're not going to feel comfortable lending to one another and loosening this credit crunch.
From New York City, our bureau chief there, Jill Barshay. Thank you, Jill.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street loved the Fed early, became less enchanted as the day wore on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Oil settled above $94 a barrel today. A government report on lower inventories set speculators buying. You know, when we talk about oil, it's usually a variety called light sweet crude. It's the easiest to refine into things that consumers can use. Down on the other end of the scale, heavy oil reserves are estimated to be in the trillions of barrels worldwide. Getting that black gold out is a huge and expensive problem because basically you have to melt it first. But researchers say they might have discovered a cheaper way. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
No one really knows how much oil's left on Earth, but experts do know that at least half the oil already discovered is trapped in the ground. This heavy oil, as it's called, is what's left over after companies take out conventional oil. But scientists think they've found a way to get at this stuff using bacteria.
Microorganisms actually eat oil, and in the process of eating it, they generate methane.
Jennifer Adams at the University of Calgary worked on the research. She says it's possible to accelerate bacteria's natural processes, capture the methane they generate, and then turn it into energy. Adams says the method could be used near oil fields that require a lot of energy to exploit, like Canada's oil sands. These are tar-like petroleum deposits buried in sand. Tom Wallen with Energy Intelligence says traditional oil production's dropped in Canada, but the research could fuel a surge in alternative oil production.
Tar sands production is coming on so fast that it's more than completely displacing the decline in the old fields, and Canadian exports to the U.S. are growing significantly.
Wallen says the research could be a huge boon, even if it only increases the amount of oil extracted by 2 or 3%. Fadel Gate with Oppenheimer & Company brokerage firm is skeptical, though. He's seen discoveries come and go.
Things that work in the lab not necessarily guaranteed to work commercially.
Researchers say the process is about 5 years from commercialization. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
There were some new numbers on the trade deficit today. Higher oil prices and imports for the holiday season helped push the trade gap to its highest level since July. That, in the way the global economy works, brings me to a story about apples, actually apple juice, and China. The Chinese don't drink much apple juice, yet they produce two-thirds of the world's supply of it. This has been a bad year for the Chinese apple crop, which is going to hurt us at the checkout counter. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
The U.S. is the world's biggest apple juice importer, but now domestic consumption in China is rising. And independent consultant Desmond O'Rourke says other countries are also increasing their appetites for apple juice.
The demand is growing fairly rapidly, particularly in Russia, because of the oil wealth that they now have. So we've got a big increase in demand and at the same time, shortage in supply.
Bad weather hurt crops in China as well as Poland and Hungary. On top of supply issues, prices are getting pushed up by speculators. O'Rourke says it's similar to the mania seen in the petroleum industry.
Essentially, people aren't so much concerned about what's available on the market today as what might be coming along. In other words, nobody ever wants to get caught short.
And prices may be headed even higher. Iowa State University economics professor Helen Jensen says U.S. companies are pressuring Chinese suppliers to ensure the safety of imports.
As those manufacturers look closely at the sourcing of their products, they're also looking at making requirements in contracts for imported products that are likely to add costs.
In this country, Desmond O'Rourke says domestic apple growers benefit from rising juice prices.
A year ago, they were getting about $40 a ton. Currently, they're getting between $180 and $200 a ton.
Eventually, those higher prices will affect consumers. In the last few years, O'Rourke says retailers have become more willing to pass along higher food costs to customers. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
It's all over but the voting for Rupert Murdoch and the Dow Jones Company. Dow shareholders, that's mainly the Bancroft family, are expected to formally approve the takeover by Murdoch's News Corp tomorrow. They'll get $5 billion in exchange for giving up the Wall Street Journal. Stacey Vanek Smith takes a look now at what's in store for the companies and for the paper.
News Corp is the third largest media conglomerate in the world, with revenues of nearly $30 billion. It owns Fox News, HarperCollins, MySpace, and the Times of London, among other things. Still, the Wall Street Journal was a special score for CEO Rupert Murdoch.
It's the newspaper he reads when he gets up every morning. I think he's had his eye on it since he moved to America.
John Cassidy is a staff writer for The New Yorker who's profiled Murdoch. He says Murdoch is already making the journal his own.
From all I hear, he's very excited about taking it over and, you know, he's already down there walking around the newsroom, meeting people.
And making changes. Word is, Murdoch will beef up the journal's coverage of art and politics to directly challenge the New York Times. He's also expected to make the journal's website free. The changes are being watched closely. When Murdoch's News Corp made a bid for Dow Jones last spring, many critics viewed the deal like this.
Join me, and together we can rule the galaxy.
After all, the Wall Street Journal is one of the most respected papers in the country, and Murdoch is known for injecting his politics into coverage at Fox News and the New York Post. Jeff Jarvis writes media blog BuzzMachine.com. He predicts Murdoch will be more prudent with the journal.
My faith is not in Murdoch's journalism. My faith is that he's too smart to turn the Wall Street Journal into Fox News.
Jarvis says Murdoch paid a premium for the Wall Street Journal's reputation, and he has big plans to leverage that asset. Jarvis says Murdoch will invest in the brand's future, and when he bought it, ad revenue at the paper was flat.
The Bancrofts, who of course had owned it, they weren't managing, they weren't investing. Here's someone who really wants to invest in the future of the Wall Street Journal as an international omni-media brand.
Murdoch plans to increase the TV and internet presence of Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal reporters will likely be all over the burgeoning Fox Business Channel. Tom Rosensteel is the director for the Project of Excellence in Journalism. He says Murdoch is one of the few people who has a real vision for the news business.
Rupert Murdoch sees the news as an emerging industry, and he sees newspapers as the core of that, because they provide the content that will be distributed in these new ways.
In fact, Murdoch's purchase of Dow Jones is a lot like the deals he made for Fox Studios and MySpace, where he paid a big premium. Hal Vogel heads up Vogel Capital Management, a media investment firm. He says News Corp is making a good bet.
They will probably see a pretty good return on their investment, but it will take time. And that is not atypical for Rupert Murdoch. He's willing, historically, to lose a lot of money initially, and then see it come back in a very strong position in a few years.
The New Yorker's John Cassidy acknowledges that Murdoch might make purists cringe, but he says the Australian-born Murdoch is also one of the few moguls willing to invest in the flailing newspaper business.
Murdoch always strikes fear into the hearts of a certain type of American journalist because he isn't a sort of hands-off American-style proprietor. But, you know, given the climate we're in now, I think people might think slightly differently about Murdoch.
And Murdoch may be thinking slightly differently about Dow Jones, too. Buzz Machine's Jeff Jarvis says the 76-year-old sees the Wall Street Journal as his legacy, and he'll do everything in his power to protect its reputation. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Republican presidential candidates had their umpteenth debate this afternoon in Iowa. The Democrats get their turn tomorrow. All the usual topics were on the table: immigration, national security, health care, too. In the Democratic field, mandates have become the health care sticking point. Should Americans be required to buy health insurance? The closer the early primaries get, the more heated the political rhetoric. But commentator Robert Reich says Democrats ought to just cool down.
Given the myriad ways universal health insurance might otherwise be organized, single-payer, employer mandate, vouchers, tax credits, the Democratic consensus is striking. All of their major proposals require employers either to provide coverage to employees or contribute to the cost of coverage. All create purchasing pools that will offer insurance to anyone who doesn't get it from an employer. All preserve freedom of choice of doctor, cover children, and aim to save money through more preventive care, better management of chronic disease, and standardized information technology. And all subsidize lower-income families, with revenues coming from letting the Bush tax cuts expire. The one issue they're squabbling over, mandates, is a sideshow. All plans would cover a large majority of those who currently lack insurance. So apart from undocumented immigrants who aren't covered by any of the plans, mandates are relevant to only around 3% of the population. Now, Hillary Clinton thinks this 3% is mostly young and healthy and should be required to buy insurance in order to bring costs down for everyone who isn't. Obama thinks they're mostly people who won't be able to afford even subsidized premiums, so they just ignore any mandate. As a practical matter, the difference comes down to timing and sequencing. Clinton wants to start with a mandate. Obama doesn't want to, but says if it turns out most of this remaining 3% are young and healthy, he'll go along with a mandate too. Now, it's expected that gloves come off in the final weeks of a primary campaign, but by warring over mandates, Democrats are leading with their chins. It's the least important aspect of what they're offering. It's also, to many Americans, the least attractive because it conjures up a big government bullying people into doing what they'd rather not. The public is ready for universal health insurance, but to get it enacted after January 2009, Democrats need to start building a movement in support of the big and important reforms universal health insurance requires, on which Democrats happen to agree.
Robert Reich was the Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His newest book is called Super Capitalism. Send us your thoughts when you get a minute. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, charities get money under one condition, just do what they do best.
And I have to tell you, I just couldn't believe my ears when I heard that.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed up 41 points today after a 200-point open. That's a third of 1%. The blue chips met the bell at 13,473. The NASDAQ rose 18.7-tenths of 1% to 2671. The S&P 500 edged up 8.6-tenths%, 1486 there. Exxon's shares pumped up 1.8-tenths%. Cisco, the largest maker of computer networking equipment, popped 2.7-tenths% higher. AT&T zipped up 5.7-tenths%, and shares of 3M rose 2.4% today. But persistent fears over the mortgage mess left some behind. Washington Mutual slipped 7.8%. Citigroup was down more than 5%. Bank of America lost 2.7%. Sally Mae plummeted 10.8% today when acquisition talks fell apart. It was the worst drop in 14 years for the country's biggest college loan lender. Bond prices dropped. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.09%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. And by Siemens, from generators that power cities to light bulbs for homes, from factory automation to medical diagnostics. Siemens, 70,000 U.S. employees providing solutions for America. Every day's marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for November. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing on shopping smart and avoiding holiday scams. And formerly blacklisted professionals in the entertainment industry convene at the National Press Club. They'll hold a discussion marking the 60th anniversary of the Hollywood blacklist. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal.
When I give, I get a sense of joy.
A sense of giving back.
I feel happy about making someone else happy.
It's just karma.
Up at the top of this program every day, you hear from the money people. Marketplace is supported by, and then often the name of a foundation. Those foundations control about $550 billion worth of charitable assets in this country. They give away billions, too. And today, as our philanthropy series continues, how many foundations have taken a page from the for-profit handbook? Ashley Montite reports.
It's mid-afternoon at the Harlem Children's Zone, a nonprofit that supports poor families in New York City. It offers parenting classes, health services, and schooling for kids. On the second floor, a class of preschoolers in maroon and gray uniforms is just settling down for their afternoon nap. Four-year-old Nigel seems confident his education is off to a good start.
I always learn about numbers and letters.
So what did you learn today?
A and B.
The Harlem Children's Zone receives funding from various sources, including the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation. In the past few years, the foundation has changed the way it does business. It used to support several causes. Now it has a single aim, helping disadvantaged kids become successful adults. It's also changed its strategy. Today, it finds charities with proven track records and gives them money to spend as they wish.
And I have to tell you, I just couldn't believe my ears when I heard that.
Jeffrey Canada is CEO of the Harlem Children's Zone. He was surprised because foundations usually attach strings to their largesse. They come up with a goal, then pick a charity to achieve it. Sometimes the foundation's goal and the charity's own vision don't quite match. But because the charities need the money, they don't have much choice. Canada says the Clark Foundation is allowing him to spend its money on his own dream. He's getting more families into his program, and he's extending his educational offerings all the way down to preschoolers.
And because it was our own plan, my whole staff became very heavily invested because it was ours versus someone else's plan that we then had to sell to people and say, this is the next thing we ought to be doing.
Of course, there were some strings attached. Nancy Rube is president of the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation. She says the foundation adjusted its approach to funding nonprofits so it was all about results.
Ensuring that our investments in those organizations were tied to performance metrics.
Rube says the foundation works out a business plan with the grantee and agrees on targets. As long as the targets are met, the grant money keeps flowing. Foundations of all sizes are beginning to pay more attention to measuring their effectiveness. Phil Buchanan is president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy. He says in many cases it's because they're run by relatively young entrepreneurs
who tend to be pretty impatient to see results. They've seen results in their business ventures very quickly, and they want to see results in their philanthropic work quickly as well.
The Clark Foundation's new approach to supporting the Harlem Children's Zone seems to be working out so far. Canada's organization hit around 95% of its targets last year in areas like improving reading scores and getting kids who were seriously behind up to school readiness level. Nancy Rube says the foundation's decision to change tactics is making it a more effective donor. Key to its strategy is finding experts like Canada and others
who are delivering proven services and know what to do to make a critical difference in the lives of young people.
Foundations can still feel warm and fuzzy about their mission, perhaps even more so now they can measure the effects of their donations. And with these kinds of business practices in place, no one applying for funding can consider them a soft touch. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
So now we know many foundations are focusing their grant giving. Some in the field believe charities can also improve their social returns by becoming investors and not just donors. It's an idea called mission investing. Mark Kramer is the founder of FSG Consulting. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Is this a place where philanthropy and good old-fashioned business common sense sort of meet?
Absolutely. You know, we're used to thinking about social issues as in the field of philanthropy and business as making money and never the twain shall meet. But when you start to think about social issues, they often have an economic component. Whether you're thinking about affordable housing or poverty or health care, these are all fundamentally economic issues. And the solutions have to involve the business community and the investment community, as well as the philanthropic and nonprofit community.
Help me understand, though, how the people with the money get more bang for their buck with mission investing rather than just giving the money away.
Well, there are some kinds of enterprises that can grow based on the revenues they're able to generate. And what they really need is investment capital more than they need a grant. To go a bit far afield, there's one example I love. It's a company called Waste Concern that was started in Dhaka in Bangladesh, where the government didn't collect waste from the streets in the slums. And two engineers figured out that they could hire some of the unemployed people in the slums to collect the garbage. They could compost it, create organic fertilizer, actually sell carbon credits. And it took philanthropic money to get the business started, but in 7 years, they've now scaled up to serve 3 million people.
How do you make the trade-off, though, between market risk, which these kinds of investments obviously have, and social responsibility?
Well, it's interesting. I'm actually out here in San Francisco to attend a conference that's called the Zero Trade-Off Conference, because people tend to assume that there is a trade-off, that more financial return means less social impact and less social, and vice versa. And our experience is that that's simply not the case. It's interesting. Goldman Sachs has recently created a division called GS Sustain that looks at sustainability factors in making public equity investments. And they find that their portfolio has outperformed the world index by 25% over the last couple of years.
Frame this for me in a larger context, though. How big a slice of the overall philanthropy sector is mission investing?
It's still tiny. You know, foundations in the United States hold about $600 billion in assets. And we calculate that there's somewhere around $200 million a year that's going into mission investing. So it's tiny. What I will say is that it had been very, very stable for about 25 years. And in the last 5 years, it's been growing at a compound rate of about 16% a year, but clearly off a very small base.
Whatever happened to the good old-fashioned grant? Does it not work anymore to simply give a group X amount of money and say, there, go out and do good?
Of course, that is still the overwhelmingly dominant activity of foundations. It's not that it doesn't work, but I think people are beginning to shift their focus from merely thinking about giving away money and supporting the many worthy nonprofits out there to thinking instead about how do we actually tackle and solve social problems? What are all the different levers that we can use to try and make change on this issue?
Mark Kramer is a managing director and a co-founder of FSG Social Impact Advisors. He's also a senior fellow at Harvard University. Mr. Kramer, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
We have a link to that project in Bangladesh that Mark mentioned. Just go to marketplace.org. You'll also find other stories in our series on new trends in philanthropy there. It continues tomorrow, that series does, with Philanthropy Online.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, dedicated to serving their clients worldwide with a passion for the business of accounting. On the web at grantthornton.com. And by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, day in which the economy becomes a YouTube posting.
Are you the potential victim of a foreclosure scam?
That's a new web ad by Freddie Mac. The lender says 25% of homeowners facing foreclosure go to the internet first when they look for help. That is, of course, where they get into trouble.
Let's shut the door on fraud.
Get out!
Not you, of course. You can stay. But that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 41 points, a third of 1%. The Nasdaq hiked up 18.7%. The S&P 500 put on 8 points. That is 0.6% there. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornone, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, charities wake up to the web.
People are going on the internet to talk about the issues that they care about and the organizations that they care about. And they're going to be doing that whether your organization is there with them or not.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money.
Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.